Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're back for part two of the discussion of the offense in that classic game against the Bengals. The 35-34 win really had everything, and it is a joyous conversation, to say the least. We talked a little bit on the defensive show about how different a conversation it would be had the Bengals made that two-point conversion. The Ravens had not subsequently recovered. But here to do that with me is Jim Zipko. Jim, how you doing?
Great, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Oh, always my pleasure, Jim. And I want to talk about a couple of things we said in the first episode, just so we remember some things and direct people to that, because it's really worth a listen. Did talk a lot about offensive scheme for the Ravens, how they came out with some new wrinkles to try and, I think, defend against some things the Bengals did in the first game, and particularly heavy use of simulated pressure. The Bengals used a ton of simulated pressure in that first game, and they didn't do it at all in this game. Not a single time did they drop two from the line of scrimmage. So they really changed the game plan dramatically, and were, as Jim pointed out, very effective at it for a substantial portion of the game. Jim brought some great numbers about the receivers in terms of success rate. We discussed that a little bit. And notable was that Bateman had success on all six of his receptions, which is not something that's obvious. That's success measured by, are you keeping up with the appropriate percentage of remaining yardage to the sticks? So listen to the description if you'd like to do that. The Ravens used a lot of set and chip blockers. As we went into that, relative specifically to the number of pass rushers used. Ravens have a whole bunch of record ball going on. One notable one that was ended, a bunch of others that are continuing. A lot of that is in the first episode. And of course, we talked about Keaton Mitchell, where the Ravens really can hope to get to at the best in terms of the AFC playoff picture and whatnot. So there's a lot in a jam-packed first episode. It's got Jim and all kinds of great information in it. So please take a listen if you would. And we'll go ahead and we'll start the second episode now.
Yeah. So Ken, I was wondering if you had some stuff that we talked a little bit about maybe different defensive scheme that the Bengals brought this time. I was wondering how that impacted the offensive line play.
Yeah, so I guess in a general synopsis that the it had a pretty average game in aggregate. We talked a little bit about the ATS and pressure breakdown. It's a good game when you can get one pressure per ATS. You only allow one pressure per ample time space, and they were 11 and 11 in that category, those categories. I guess it is, but they also.
I'm sorry. Can you explain that again? So per ample time and space opportunity. Oh, you
allow
want to have
no more than one pressure.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's a good game. If you 1 and 1 is a good game. And in fact, if you're a defense and you allow one for every pressure you get, that would be a bad game. And the Ravens have had some of that recently. They allowed 58% ample time and space in this previous game against Denver. So they're very fortunate to come out of that one with a win. But that was the highest in years, by the way. But this game, no, it was good in terms of the balance of ATS and pressure. They didn't allow any sacks. That's of course good. Only one quarterback hit. I'm for Lamar getting dropped to the ground as few times as often.
Yeah.
But here's the bad thing: 6 flags, and not the amusement park. Every single one of them was penalized at least once.
What was the penalty on Stanley? I don't remember.
A false start by him was the only one. So that's the least serious of anybody. A false start, because it's not a declinable foul, is only a -2 in terms of scoring.
Doesn't give the defense any kind of free play or any kind of choices.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
Did he have trouble with – so was he kind of one-on-one with Hendrickson most of the game?
And quite a bit. Had a lot of trouble with him. So that was, you know, one of the ongoing things. Stanley allowed 5 pressures in this game, and they were full pressures. He didn't have any that were shared. Sometimes that'll get you off the hook for a little bit of the points. He had a third of a quarterback hit. I think it was Hendrickson who actually took him down, but other people were also complicit in the arrangement. And then he had another where he wasn't quite quick enough to get the outside and make a block that caused a run for a loss. It goes down as a penetration on the score sheet. He only had 3 missed blocks, which was good. The false start is a relatively minor negative, but it only adds up to a 0.58 score. And even with a big adjustment, and he got almost the maximum possible for being against Hendrickson at 0.09, that only got him up to 0.67, which is still a D at tackle. If I'm going to pull some positives from this game, I think he had 5 level 2 blocks, so that's good. One pancake, one of the penetration he allowed was actually on a pull, so he only got 1 point on 3 pulls, 1 net point. And then he had 1 highlight. I think the highlight was behind the play, on the backside of a run play where he made 2 blocks. That's a Stanley special. He does that so well in terms of he knows when he's just done enough to slow somebody down that they mm-hmm. can't possibly catch up to the play. And then he'll try and catch a defensive back, so he gets another guy out of it. He's very effective at that. I'm generally happy with what we're seeing from Ronnie for the year, but he's had 2 of the last 3 games. He hasn't played particularly well. And if you're going to say this might be okay for the Ravens, because I think one of the reasons you'd say is that a lot of the pressures he gave up, he was allowing the cone to be impeded, but not necessarily Lamar to be touched. And when
you've talked about this before, him and Lamar, how he has, like, he keeps his body between him and Lamar. So he like, he might bump Lamar with his butt or whatever, but the defender isn't grabbing him. Is that still true? Is he still showing that kind of positional game with the pass rushers versus vis-a-vis Lamar?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I'd say, first of all, generally, very much so. Hendrickson did get by him a couple times, once inside and maybe even twice outside. So it wasn't perfect or anything this game, but he does allow some bump pressures that Lamar has been highly adept. And, you know, we talked about this in the first episode, but Lamar, under pressure in this game, threw for 12.8 yards per pass. He was, you know, 9.3 yards better than what my expectation is on those plays. So it's not like the pressure that Stanley gave up, which I think included, let me look at it to make sure here, but I think he gave up a pressure on the 84-yard throw. He did. He was beaten inside by 91, and Hendrickson was actually coming into his face at kind of the fringe of the cone, actually. Mm-hmm. Lamar got the ball out. He was affected in terms of his willingness to step into that throw. But then, of course, the ball was caught. Wallace makes a great play, and that's a lot of his advantage, obviously, for the day in terms of relative to his expectation.
Right. I think the thing that we wonder about Stanley is always, you know, so he had this multi-year span where he, you know, had the devastating injury, the long comeback, you know, the re-injury, the comeback. I think that the overriding question that I had in previous years about Stanley was, would we ever see the great player that he was again? And this is maybe the same question phrased differently, like, what percent of mm-hmm. old Stanley could he come back to? If you had to answer one of those two questions, you know, about Stanley and how he's played this year, not necessarily this game, what would you say about that?
So if I'm it's called asking somebody for a qualitative answer with an actual number. So you're saying, what percentage is he back to?
Well, you know, so I figured I was talking to a quant guy, so yes, I would offer you that option. But, you know, I think of it as the other way, like, how far back?
Sure. I think he has been most of the player that he was at his very best here. And part of that is because even in 2019, I scored him for a lot more pressures than PFF did.
Okay.
So it was a case of, I think he was allowing the cone to get more damage, but it was, that's when, I mean, it's really been 5 years of people hearing me say the same thing about Stanley has been allowing some bump pressures and some, you know, in imperiling the cone on his side a little bit. But Lamar is perfectly fine with it. I mean, he, as long as he's not getting dragged down or his arm's getting hit or he's not giving up quarterback hits instead of those pressures,
right?
Then it's really good. And at the end of last year, we saw something different from Stanley that was a huge improvement, was he was attacking players outside the perimeter of the pocket more and creating less risk of imperiling of the cone during that time. I was very impressed by that. That really hasn't continued to this year. He's really reverted to what I would call more traditional Stanley style of basically giving up ground in order to maintain mirror.
Mm-hmm. So we lay this out talking about the offensive line left to right. And so that would mean Rosengarten, the discussion of Rosengarten would be separated by, you know, three players from the discussion of Stanley. Would you mind if we change that a little bit?
It is your call, my friend.
All right. Well, so the reason I say that is we draft Rosengarten, and he is a blindside tackle prospect, right? In college, he blocked for a lefty quarterback. And so there's and Stanley had this long, long, you know, tale of, you know, post-injury where, you know, we thought that, you know, his career was over, you know, it might be time to wind up that contract. And we drafted this blindside guy. Before I ask you, I would like to tell you that I'm in no hurry to run Stanley out of town and put Rosengarten over on the left side. What is your take on Rosengarten's upside as a replacement for Stanley and the need to move on from Stanley?
So the need to move on from Stanley, I don't think is high at all. I mean, I think he will be a good left tackle in the National Football League for several more years, barring a new injury. So that's very positive. So, I'd be in favor of re-signing him based on the money being right. You know, yep. I remember the end of the first Clay Liston fight, they asked, Muhammad Ali's trainer at the time, who was the guy, Angelo Dundee,
yeah,
his trainer his entire career. He asked, you know, what about a rematch with Liston? And you know, basically without saying, did you just see what he did to Liston? Of course, we'll take a rematch. He goes, I don't think there'll be any problem if the money's right. That's my feeling about Stanley here in this case. And unless the money is ridiculous, I mean, yeah. I think that, you know, you find a way. And, you know, this is a case where I kind of hope Ronnie would put a value on being a Ravens Ring of Honor member.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps maybe if it's not that, maybe it's, you know, playing again with Lamar and having a better chance to win a ring. Maybe it's playing with an organization that generally has a higher probability of winning a ring than going somewhere else where your chance is probably just not going to be as good.
So you're not talking not quite full-blown hometown discount, but something of, you know, valuing.
$1.5 million less of AAV per year, if I had to put a number on it. So maybe he makes $18.5 million here, he makes $20 million somewhere else. That kind of
so
discount.
So of value, there is value to being here, you're hoping, in his mind. Go ahead.
No, that's pretty much where I am, and if we're talking about Rosengarten, then and how that relates to it, is that what you're going to?
I was going to say one more thing about Stanley, and then move on to Rosengarten. To me, the relationship between I'm not in the locker room. I'm just another jerk sitting on his couch watching TV with the rest of you guys and trying to read into the body language and like what we see them saying. But to me, the Ronnie Stanley Lamar Jackson relationship is one of the most important relationships on the team for Lamar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he was a rookie in 2018, when he was a first time Pro Bowler in 2019, they had a big brother, little brother energy that was quite charming. And when Lamar had frustrations in 2021 and 2022, when he threw a temper tantrum on the field in Tampa, Ronnie was the guy who grabbed him and calmed him down. Now Ronnie's the one that Lamar is yelling at. Because, you know, Ronnie's drawing penalties or whatever, but that's one of the relationships that I trust the most on the team and would not like, I'm not eager to see that disrupted. So,
yeah, I think that's very valid point is that it's a great relation to keep. And if Lamar, he's not in a position right now, cause it's not a contract year to make conditions upon the team. But I think, you know, one of the things he could really say once is please, you know, keep Ronnie Stanley around, even if you have to make another sacrifice. I mean, they might come to him and say, hey, look, we can afford one of Mark Andrews or Ronnie Stanley. And honestly, I think that may be true. Who do you want?
Ooh, he would pick Mark in that case, I think.
I'm not sure. Because I mean he likes Isaiah Likely too.
Sure.
And Charlie Kohler is a good backup tight end, and they could draft another. And Andrews is a little bit older. You know, he's not older than Stanley, but he's a little bit older in terms of where he is on the aging curve relative to Likely and Kohler. I'm not sure 100% what he'd say. But the reason the Ravens shouldn't ask him is that it can't be based on friendship and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure how Lamar would feel about it. And you know, they might have to bring him in and have the conversation with him after they've made the decision and say, hey, look, I know this is not going to be popular with you, but we've got to cut Mark Andrews. And I know he's an incredible target of yours, incredible friend of yours. But the choice was between him and Ronnie. And we can only
planet theory. There's only so many humans on the planet who can, you know, be that big as Ronnie Stanley and dance with Trey Hendrickson.
There you go.
And the Ravens can draft tight ends, you know, and I'm not in favor of seeing either player go, but I'm surprising myself by taking this position, you know, because Mark Andrews is the more recent All Pro, and he's, by the way, on an incredible streak the last six games. But so that was depressing. Okay. So that leads us right into Rosengarten. How did he play in this game, and what do you think of his growth over the season and his potential in 2025?
All right. So one of the things we've seen these last 2 weeks in particular is that I don't think that his mirror is quite there yet. And it may be some things about dealing with the quickness of NFL level defensive ends. I mean, he had problems anchor wise at the collegiate level, at the national championship game against some really pedestrian guys that were at Michigan. You know, a seventh round draft pick, Harrell. There's another guy's coming out in the draft this year. It wasn't an exceptional group. It wasn't like they had David Ajabo and Aiden Hutchinson, you know, that year. This was a group of guys who were several notches down, and he had, you know, problem after problem in terms of anchoring against them. But, you know, I think his mirror was showing up pretty well until the last couple of games. This game had a lot of problems giving up, being beaten outside, being beaten inside and whatnot. I'll go through it here quickly. He 57 plays, 47 blocks. He missed four, gave up half a penetration. Again, that's a shared loss on a run play. Three full pressures, a third of a quarterback hit. So he was part of the phone boothing of the pocket on the one that I think PFF probably gave it to Stanley, because I think it was on Hendrickson's side, or Hendrickson got it rather. And then he had an illegal formation penalty. And illegal information and false start are not the same. A false start is a pre-snap 5 yards only penalty.
They stop the play. The play is dead.
The play is dead. Illegal formation is you give a free play to the defense play.
So I think people don't understand that, right? Because we think of free plays for the offense, like on an offside, you know, but the thing is that the defense could create a sack fumble, you know, a pick six or something like that, like a disaster. And they
loss have of five, loss of five, which would be a loss of down. I mean, you know, there's a lot of plays. If it's a third down for starters, you know, it third and four.
Yeah.
It's third and nine on the false start. It's either third and nine or you're off the field.
Right.
On an illegal an IDP. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So
now you talked about, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Yeah, 0.63 with adjustment, 0.68. I got a D. Only two level two blocks. There was nothing special in terms of highlights or pulls or anything like that, which is why he got along with the fact that Trey Hendrickson is not on that side, why he got a significantly lower adjustment than Stanley. So anyway, D.
So that's a D from the left tackle and a D from the right tackle on a game where the quarterback posted a 140 quarterback rating.
Yeah.
Did not sack.
That is an unusual pairing, and you've captured that correctly. We're not through with the D's on this offensive line.
I'm sure we are not. Yeah. So the disparity right between Lamar's production and the offensive line play is startling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is there any, go ahead.
It has been the last few weeks. I was just going to say last week, he only got three ample time and space opportunities and he had perfect passer rating. So, you know, on 20 passes plus sacks. So
I don't want to deviate too far from the offensive line, but a key factor that makes this offense go is Lamar's ability to make a guy miss in the backfield and keep the play alive. Mm-hmm. And and throw not under pressure. Like he skates away, like he's flushed down and he's no longer pressured when he finally throws the pass. Bill Walsh said way back when he, in his first book, he was talking about the drafting of Joe Montana. And he said that on a play action pass, when the quarterback turns back around, he's going to have to make one guy miss because one guy will be unblocked on a play action pass. And that was one of the reasons why he preferred a quarterback with mobility. And I'm still talking about Joe Montana here. If you think about his first great highlight, the catch, Dwight Clark in the back of that end zone, the catch comes after the throw, which is Joe Montana skating smoothly back away from, you know, Randy White and Ed Too Tall Jones and all those guys. So mobility in a quarterback, in order to make an offense go, like we see that in Aaron Rodgers, you know, peak Aaron Rodgers, we see that in Joe Montana. We see that, you know, so that that's not an uncommon factor for great quarterbacking, that mobility is a huge important component of the passing game. But Lamar, I'm doing a lot of hand waving here. Like Lamar is just a level or three above that, I think.
Right. I mean, if go watch some Steve Walsh or Steve Young, I should say.
Yeah.
Playing for the 49ers. And some of it's unfair because a lot of times he's literally running on a baseball diamond in the highlights you'll see. But the guy handled like a shopping cart relative to Lamar. I mean, it's just he's a completely different guy in terms of.
And he was a great
running quarterback. Yes. Not saying anything negative about the guy as a passer, as a quarterback, even as a runner relative to other guys of his day. No. But if Michael
about Vick, Hall of Famer Steve Young, I understand that you're not saying anything bad about him.
But if Michael Vick was one level below Lamar as a runner, which I really believe there's a complete difference in terms of leverage and straight line style and whatnot, then the guy who's three or four levels below him is Steve Young, and he's still a great running quarterback. So
unbelievable. So Lamar's 27 this year. I've been noticing a number of plays where Lamar lingers in front of a pass rusher and then dances away from him, and the pass rusher grazes his hip with the pass rusher's fingertips. Okay, so Lamar's 27. Mm-hmm. Next year, he'll be a year older. A year after that, he'll be a year older than that. Is he playing on a razor-thin margin where his athleticism is good enough to allow some pressure events to be non-events, and that margin is going to disappear in 2 years?
Every pitcher loses their great fastball at some point and
has
to learn how to adjust. And this is the big one for Lamar. And I think he lost a lot of weight this year to try and maintain some of his mobility. I think that was a good choice as it's working out. I think, you know, he will probably try and do other things to improve his on-field throws. And the big one that you know, we just saw one of in this game from Thursday night is on-schedule throws. If he can make an occasional on-schedule throw, he becomes that much more deadly. And, you know, they acted like Bateman and Lamar had this mind meld for years. And of course, this is one of the first times we've literally ever seen it. It's a true on-schedule throw to Lamar, to Bateman, where it's out before Bateman turns.
He's been doing that more, though. And I would say I said a lot of this to you, but I don't remember if it was in the pre-production meeting or if it was the actual first segment of the podcast. But it was that announcers have been talking about what's different about Lamar this year versus prior years. And they're trying to compliment Lamar and they're trying to communicate something to their audience. And they keep saying things that are not true. Like this year, Lamar is looking to stay in the pocket to throw. He always did that. This year, Lamar is hitting those touch passes. He's always hit those touch passes. Yeah. What is different from Lamar this year is the pre-snap phase and the quick throws, the one step in shotgun or the three step throws, like the one you were talking about to Bateman. Those are the difference between Lamar this year and in prior seasons.
And if I was to assign point values to those things, I'd say the pre-snap adjustments in particular has been like a 10 in a relative sense. And I'd say the on-schedule throws, I'm even maybe a little disappointed relative to how much he could have grown. I mean, it's great to see him. Great to see one like last year. I just don't think there have been a lot of them this year. So, yes, more than previous years. Yes, absolutely. A 3-point consideration, a 4-point consideration, maybe, but 10-point consideration for sure for the pre-snap consideration. Because that's
go ahead.
That's Lamar, not just talking to linemen, talking about what's going on. It's Lamar processing what's doing as he's walking around and telling people what assignments they have.
Yeah. And I also think that a huge part of however big the tick up in on schedule throws have been due to the work in the pre-snap phase, some decision making, making. And I think that Lamar values his ability to make things happen. You know, like he's never in, so long as he retains the ability to make a guy miss and keep a play alive, he's probably never going to be the pure Tom Brady on schedule thrower.
Yes.
That even he could be, because he's gonna, you know, the on schedule throw might be, you know, a short throw and he wants to make a medium throw. You know what I mean? So I don't mind that so much. I think that he's not taking some on schedule throws that he sees because he wants to go for a little bit more.
I mean, seriously, let's start with, how are you going to argue with 136.1 quarterback rating over the last 8 games?
It's
he's been so successful. I don't want him to do anything different until down some.
You know, yes.
Until he can't do that. So anyway, we they always give the business example of Polaroid camera and how, you know, they had to decide to change when they were doing fine, you know, because they kind of knew that the market was not going to persist in the way it was going forward. And there is some of that for Lamar that'd be nice to figure out kind of in advance, some of the tricks to making on schedule throws in preparation for 1 or even 3 years from now, when it's going to be more important as a part of his game.
My sense is that he's done that. My sense is that he's not doing as many on schedule throws because he can still do the other thing. And he likes the intermediate throws, you know, the cost benefit on the intermediate versus like the short throw, but he's already laid the groundwork for doing the thing that you describe in the pre-snap phase and those quick throws that he is taking. So when you talk about laying the groundwork, I think that the things that, you know, Todd Monken and he have worked on in the offseason, I think the things that you see Lamar doing in terms of, so they had that great interview comment when he made that big play to Justice Hill last game. Or last week maybe, and he said, a reporter asked him, what did you see pre-snap, you know, did you know, you know, whatever, and he said, I'm not going to say that, I'm just going to say I knew where I was going with the ball. Okay. When the ball was snapped. And so that kind of thing, that groundwork, I believe, is being laid for, you know, 2 years from now or whenever he's lost a quarter step, but he still can make the plays that he can make. So he's not using it all the time because he wants to go deeper. That's what I think.
It's going to be discreet in terms of how this runs off. People, you know, one
discreet
of the things,
like EET, or discreet as in sep, you know what I mean?
Discreet in meaning he won't like have a linear loss of speed unless things really continue on. Like there'll be a drop because of some injury.
That will
be fairly significant. And then he'll have to play hurt and he might not be as mobile when that happens. And he'll be significantly disadvantaged if he doesn't have some of these other tools in the box.
So, do you mind if we keep scrambling along the offensive line, not doing them in
absolutely order? Let's do it.
So the player that's next to, I'm sorry. I wanted to ask you one more thing about Rosengarten. In terms of his play, not so great. Is there any possibility, you know, I don't know that how many times in college he played a Thursday night game after a Sunday game. You know, he's still a very young player. Also, we have to, you know, at some point be, you know, there is such a thing as a rookie wall, or there sometimes is. Do you think that Rosengarten could be dealing with some things physically that are not an injury necessarily, but are, you know, residue of a long season, or not having a body that's, you know, quite ready to bounce back on Thursday night after a Sunday game or anything like that?
Certainly that's possible. My expectations of play for any rookie are lower, period.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to say, particularly in the offensive line, where the Ravens have shown very consistent patterns of development from their players, Rosengarten's at a just about a point or two below the middle of the C range right now for the whole year. He was at a C+ earlier.
Okay.
C+ would be fantastic out of a rookie player. C is good. And C- is perfectly fine in terms of if you're a starter and you there's a lot of projected upside still you've got from that. And the Ravens have shown player after player after player have gotten way better as their careers have moved on. You know, Rick Wagner and Ryan Jensen, all these guys who were, you know, kind of marginal later round draft picks, you know, were still, you know, guys the Ravens could make something out of. Patrick McCary, James Hurst, even those guys who, you know, have had multiple positions they played and they've had the development slowed by some of these things. It's worked out. So if he could continue on at basically a C level for the rest of the years, I think the Ravens would be very excited about where he could play. I think he could end up on the left side. I think it might be the right move to try and have him stay another year on the right side based on what I see out of his, the combination of his mirror and anchor right now.
such a young player. All right, the guy next to him, Daniel Fa'alele. Maybe something. Maybe we might say different things about him and his bright future. What would you say about his play?
Yeah. This constantly there's a different frustration. It's like it's just always something with him. Emily Latella, if you remember that from Saturday Night Live, then you're as old as Jim and me. but he had 8 missed blocks in this game. A lot of those came in level 2, where he moves to level 2 and is a combination of decisiveness lack thereof, really, and movement makes him unable to find a block. It was a good game as a pass blocker for him. He had 1/2 a pressure and 1/3 of a quarterback hit, which is only, you know, -2 in points on all his pass blocking snaps, that's quite good. But then he had two penalties. He had a holding penalty, he had a false start. And I don't know for sure if the offensive holding or the false start actually stalled a drive. But the Ravens had some drive stalling penalties in this game for sure. And he ended up with 0.67 per play at guard, even with an adjustment that didn't make the C level. So it was a D. Unfortunate. 5 level 2 blocks. That was good. He was 4 out of 5 in pulls on this game, that's better than he has been doing. Pulls have been a problem for him. As bad as he's been at times, he's also been pretty good at other times. And, I'm starting to drink some of the Kool-Aid with regard to maybe this guy could still be a player. And maybe the Ravens are about ready to, cut him loose, because his last 4 games is FDCD in terms of his results. But his overall for the year is about 0.72, which puts him at
FDCD?
Those are the grades from the last 4 games.
Okay. Gotcha.
So he's been, a high D for the last 4 weeks combined. I'm sorry, for the last 4 weeks combined. For the season, he's probably D+, I would say C- at the highest. But if you were to improve just a little bit and be a C or C+ player the rest of the year, that's not a marginal improvement. I don't want to pretend like that's a micro improvement. But if you were to do that, he'd immediately project himself into the group of players that you need to try and consider signing early. And in some ways, he could be a priority, because you may really have untapped something that's going to be more value in years 4, 5, and 6. And you can get a guy after year 3, hasn't made any money in the NFL, strong desire is not the right word, strong incentive to wrap up, some generational money now. We're not talking chart-topping numbers. I mean, if he signed for 3 years, $12 million or something, would be the kind of thing I'd be talking about. James Hurst-type contract at the outside with 4 for 16, 4 for 17 kind of thing. But what's his age? I mean, he's a third-year player. I think he might be 26 right now. Let me get that real quick for you. And anyway, that's all I really had to say about Fa'alele here. Did you want to move on?
Well, I'd like to talk about the two guards together, and then maybe take a second to talk about the options for against those two guards.
According to this, Fa'alele is still only 24.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have thought he was older than that.
Well. All right. I don't have the days on the particular one I was looking at. So you want to talk about McCary next?
Yeah.
All right. So McCary had a fine game, 5 missed blocks, and he's been up and down a little bit, but he's generally at left guard, he's been more up than down. 5 missed blocks. He did have an illegal downfield penalty. I believe that stalled a drive. And that was notable because McCary had 7 penalties so far this year beforehand. 1 was declined. Now, declined is not a good thing in offensive line penalties, because it means the defense got
alternative
was
worse.
Yeah. So that often does mean a drive was stalled because of it. But he didn't have the 5 holding penalties against him had all been accepted, and none of them had stalled drives, which is remarkable.
Yeah.
That's the Lamar Jackson offense, getting them off the hook. Anyway, this week he had an illegal downfield play, and that did stall a drive. But that was his only really negative play, 0.86 with a 0.04 adjustment, got him up to an A-, 3 blocks in level 2, 2 pancakes, made 2 out of 4 on his pulls. So that's not so great, but it's better than missing them and better than a sharp stick in the eye. Anyway, a good game for McCary. And I just want to go over the last few games for him. He's had, and now it's McCary at tackle. Let me go to McCary at guard, because I have to separate this. He played a few snaps at center during this time too. But the last 6 games, He's had A minus, A, D, B plus, D, A minus. Now, when I see a pattern like that, first of all, I'm comfortable with a fair amount of game-to-game variation. And if you look at Major League Baseball box scores, it's okay that you know, Gunnar Henderson goes 0 for 4 with 3 strikeouts twice in a 6-game span, because there's going to be another game where he hits 2 homers, and there's going to be game where he makes a couple of great plays. So the game-to-game variation is kind of normal when you have high value, high severity problems that you have when they occur.
Right. So if he gives up one sack or one holding penalty, that ruins a day, but that doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. And he said two with 2 holding penalties in the last 4 games. And so those were both of the D's. Well, I'm looking at right now, there's 10 in penalties in 2 different games. And that kills your grade right there. So you're,
So what do you think of the battery, McCarrie and Fa'alele as a pair? And is there any pressure on the Ravens to make a change?
I think the pressure would all be in terms of how they want to preserve McCarrie as the next man off the bench to replace a tackle. And right now, I think that pressure is feeling low because Josh Jones has looked pretty good when he's been in the games and has not been a lot of snaps. So it's way too early to get excited about this because he didn't look good in the preseason. But he's something like he's made about 15 out of 15 or 14 out of 15 blocks at tackle this year off the bench. Let me get to it real. Yeah, Jones at tackle, 14 for 14 and making his blocks right now. So that's something I can say, oh, maybe he, you know, given a chance, he'll be a player the Ravens can depend on.
So Voorhees and Cleveland should stay where they are.
First of all, I don't want to lose either of those players, but they will lose Cleveland at the end of this year. The other reason why,
and they seem to value him not at all. They will slam the door.
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home baked cookies, vapes. Anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Ravens. So head to mood.com/Ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Ravens when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tap, also on them. Service plan required for watch or tap. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Or on his butt, just shove him out.
Yeah, it's really sad, but that may be exactly what happens. And it wouldn't surprise me if he gets caught up in the guard valuation that's going on now. And the Ravens, you know, very deep on the offensive line. They're gonna probably have to let somebody go somehow, whether it's him or Fa'alele, and they're probably gonna draft another lineman too. I mean, I would not be surprised if somewhere Cleveland signs for 3 years, $21 million, 3 years, $27 million, something like that, with nobody knowing a whole lot about who he is, just knowing what an enormous human being he is. And
playing pretty decently, I would imagine.
Yeah, played pretty reasonably for a very limited number of snaps.
Yeah. So that's interesting, right? Because I think there's a lot of discussion among fans, like, oh, Linderbaum's killing us. Oh, why isn't Cleveland getting a chance? Oh, when is Voorhees going to come back? But you know, I guess I'm going to throw myself in there. Like, I don't know what's going on, and I don't know how good the alternatives are.
Right. And it's, I have to use the tip of the iceberg analogy. You know, what we can see from Cleveland in terms of actual playing time is good. And I feel confident in my ability to judge that. But the Ravens also have all of his practice habits, so all the stuff that goes in the building, yeah. All in the classroom, all of that crap. Yep. And, you know, I just have to trust that they know better in this case.
That's true.
Of course, I thought I knew better in the case of Patrick Queen, and I was probably right that they should have had Xavier McKinney instead. And now we wouldn't be talking about this big safety problem, at least I hope now that if we had him. But anyway, it is what it is. All right. Let's go on. I've got one player left on the offensive line, so I'm just going
to jump
in.
Should we move on to Linderbaum?
Yeah.
Linderbaum.
Tyler Linderbaum had another fine game, and he's had a couple of games which have not been that great, but this is a nice recovery with a very positive game, an A-minus overall, two missed blocks, and one half a pressure. I did have an illegal man downfield, and I believe that did not kill a drive, if I recall. And I'll have to look for it here, but he just had another very good game. He always has good peripheral stats in terms of how he's let's see, McCary had one there. Let me do this real quick. Yeah, no, they ended up scoring a touchdown. In fact, he ended up scoring a touchdown on his other IDP. It was the last touchdown they scored to go up 35-28.
You're talking about anyway, peripheral stats. Collateral. Yeah,
the peripheral stats, he always has a lot of level two blocks, does well on pulls. He had one highlight block in this game, and that was the incredible block on Hubbard. Not an easy dude to block, by the way. Much bigger man than most of the guys that he would be typically blocking. And he maintained that block for 8-9 yards as Lamar ran behind him on the Lamar play from this game.
Yeah.
It was a you know, thing of beauty to see him get downfield. So he gives the Ravens a lot of value, and he would be even more valuable to the Ravens if they would have another, I think, extremely big man next to him. And there's reasons for both, you know, a player like McCary or a player like Cleveland being at left guard. If he's at left guard, you do all sorts of things with your blocking assignments. If you have big man, quick man, big man,
yep,
you know, for your three in the middle with some of the trouble that Linderbaum has still with some stunt pickup and some blitzes from level two, and just with some big interior guys, having another big man next to him would be strong medicine for that. Yeah. So I would love to see that. Of course, the compromise you make is that the guy's not going to be as good a puller.
So in illegal man downfield, we had two of those. We had McCary, mm-hmm. We had Linderbaum, and they were both, I believe, on RPOs. And I think that they both came on plays where the P was delayed a little bit. I think on the first one, Lamar had to kind of hold the ball for a second due to maybe a defender flashing or something.
Yep, exactly.
And I forget on the second one, but I think also the ball did not come out on time. Mm-hmm. Has that been – so – to me, that explains how the man got to be illegally downfield. But have we seen that before this season on RPOs with the Ravens? Like, has that been a consistent issue?
I mean, ineligible downfield has been an issue for the Ravens in the last few years. I'm not going to say it wasn't an issue at all, even during the Flacco era, but it was much less of an issue because of the nature of the offense.
Right.
And it's one of the clawback taxation elements of having a quarterback like Lamar is that you have some IDPs that are created by it. And Lamar's got to be cognizant of that. And really the linemen have to be very conscious of it. So if you're going to go a yard up the line of scrimmage, it's okay, but you got to be engaged.
Yeah.
And what we've seen some is that defensive linemen are getting very smart about throwing off that engagement. Allowing or throwing Linderbaum off, shedding him so that he goes 3 yards into level two.
Yeah.
And then it's going to get called a lot of the time. But there have been times, by the way, I try and look for it on any play. You get a zero block in my system if you're downfield on a pass play when you shouldn't be, even if it's not called. Now you get a penalty if it is called. So
yeah. So I just how big a part have RPOs been of the Monken offense this year?
I mean, so high a percentage of the Ravens offense is point related. Yeah. And not all of that, a lot of that is run and not run pass. But, you know, the Ravens, I mean, they have the ability to do triple option plays right now. And it's only like basically time of development that takes away from that. Like a true run pass option or comes out of the mesh point and is thrown is something the Ravens didn't do for a long time. They did it in 2019, three times the whole year, twice in the game against Miami. It's not as big a component as the offense as people tend to make it be.
That's what I thought too. And I thought that maybe these penalties were a result of just it's a small part of the offense. And so we had an unfamiliarity issue.
Yeah. I get your point now. Yeah. And I would agree with that. Yeah.
So, I mean, they're doing so many other things well. It's hard for me as a fan to ding them for not being amazing at this too. But I wonder if that impacts, you know, how likely they're going to be to call more of them in the near future.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. I mean, if you suddenly made it, the thing is, if you suddenly made it like 75% of the offense, that's ridiculous. Let's say you make it 35% of the offense.
Even that.
That's too high too. But if you ran most of your play action out of, RPO type concepts instead of doing it with turn your back play action or even these hand check side action out of pistol deals that they used to use a lot in 2019. If you ran it mostly, at least going towards the mesh, the offensive linemen would have to relearn what they do, and it would become less of a problem because of that. You won't have two IDPs show up for even two consecutive weeks without that being a point of emphasis for the offensive line in terms of what they're doing weekly.
True.
All right. Let's move on. This is the part of the show where I really like to get the guest to go first and talk about a player that you'd like to talk about. We'll do that for about 10 minutes, and then I hope I have some time for some questions.
So I would like to mention the big catch and run by Tylan Wallace. I was very impressed when two things about that. First, it was down the same sideline as the punt return touchdown last year. So that's his alley. And then I thought during the run, as players were trying to push him out of bounds, you could really see the effect of him having done so much punt return, because he had that core strength. And that so a punt return is a very different play from most wide receiver plays. You know, most wide receivers, you're running away from the ball. Maybe you turn back to make the catch, but then you're turning around, you know, again, 180 to go back up the field. When you're punt return, you're running straight at the guys who are running at you, and you're taking a lot of trying to make those hits, glancing hits, but you're playing physically, you're playing through contact. And I thought that when he was running down the field toward the camera, that was the shot on TV, you see defenders come in and try to hit him a glancing blow and knock him, you know, out of the field as if he were a typical wide receiver who is not accustomed to playing through contact. And this is a punt returner, and you're not going to affect him that way. So I was very impressed with just his strength and the development of playing special teams gave him on that play against those defenders.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting point. I guess I would say the thing I was most impressed as he went up the sideline was the pair of stiff arms. They were class A stiff arms both times. And it did look to me like, as he was turning the corner, as he was is forcing the first missed tackle by whoever the cornerback was on that side, it looked like Wilson kind of gave up on the play. Then Wilson said, "Oh crap, I got to get there." And then he got stiff-armed when he got there, which was just the timing was perfect for it. And then as the Wilson hit was happening, Geno Stone was kind of giving up a little bit.
He's out of bounds now. Oh, crap, he's not. Yeah.
And then he has to catch up, and he gets stiff-armed.
Yeah.
Thing of beauty. I mean, you know, both of those stiff-arms were legendary. And
so you were at the game, and you might not have been aware that there was a replay question about whether Wallace had stepped out of bounds.
Oh, I've seen it since I got home, of course.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so his toe of his cleat was in bounds, and his heel was out of bounds, but he didn't put the heel down. He was staying on his toe on that step. It's just a wonderful play.
Yeah, it was a thing of beauty. Let me pick a player. Wallace's, by the way, his play so far this year is off your yards per target metrics with the over 29 yards per target.
He is he's so crushing far. That and his success rate. So I multiply them for a YTS statistic, yards times success, and he's leading the Ravens, but it's a bit of small sample size theater there.
He's 5 for 5 in successes.
I'll have to check my spreadsheet.
Okay, but I think he's got to be close because he's had five. He was 2 for 2 before this. It's a question of were all three successes in this game, because two of them certainly.
Oh, they were in this game. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Then he's 5 for 5 because he had 2 third down conversions before were his first two catches of the year. So if he's 5 for 5, and at 29 yards per
no, target. I'm sorry. It was 2 out of 3 today.
He had one shorter game.
2 out of 3. Yeah.
But still 80% of 29 yards is going to be one of the highest numbers of all time, probably for even 5 catches.
Yeah. So he's 23 YTS and our second place player, Charlie Kolar, 8.75. And then you get Mark Andrews at 6.61, which is success rate times yards per target.
All right. It's a good statistic to put together. It's kind of like an OPS that you're putting two things together. I like the way it's done. Whenever I see statistics that don't necessarily belong together, like on base and slugging, which really, really don't belong together.
I know that bothers you a lot.
Yeah, it bothers me so much. So anyway,
is it because they're adding fractions with not unlike denominators?
No. Yeah. Actually the denominator is similar enough between plate appearances and at bats. It's the problem is the relative expectation for each item. So if the league has a 420 slugging percentage, but only a 320 on base percentage, and then you're saying 350 is as good as 350 on base is as good as 450 slugging, the other being the league average.
Yeah, yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. No, I think this is just kind of like what percent of your yards per target do you get to keep because the plays are successful?
Yes. All right. Well, life is good. I'll just pick a player that I want to talk about. Mitchell's usage, I'll talk about very briefly. Two snaps only in the game. One he ran, but it was negated by penalties. So he only had one, you know, non-penalty snap that he played, didn't touch the ball on it. I like the idea of using him as a pony player. Mm-hmm. I think he adds a misdirection component. I think he can take some. He probably takes some snaps away from Flowers if you want. He certainly can happily take some snaps away from Deontay Johnson because I think he brings you a little bit more there in terms of how the defense will react to him, you know, if nothing else.
And there's also the thunder and lightning changeup if he takes snaps from Henry.
Oh,
which
yeah.
is not the pony situation that you're talking about, but is a usage.
And that's fine too. If he gets 5 snaps a game of that and you know, 3 snaps a game of pony, 4 snaps a game of pony, I'd love that kind of a figure. I think the actually by the end of the year, the pony with Mitchell could be a much more substantial component of the Ravens' change of pace pitches that Monken has available. I think we could see it. You know, we've seen I think them at most 2 times in this game. We might have seen it 3 times in one game, but I think 2 might have been the most. Wouldn't surprise me if all of a sudden we're seeing it 5 times per game if Mitchell really ends up being a weapon that's anything like last year, and that's unlikely. It could happen.
But, you know, 2025, you know, looking forward.
There you go.
I would like to talk. Oh, please keep going.
No.
Please keep going because I have to pull up the statistics that I want to mention on the next.
Sure. Okay. Well, then I'll bring up another player.
I'm ready to mention the other player. I just wanted to, I thought you were still talking about.
All about done with Mitchell. You go ahead, my friend.
All right, Mark Andrews, I think that it's a little bit below the radar. Andrews is kind of night and day between his first 4 games and his last 6 games. So in Andrews' first 4 games, he had 6 receptions on 9 targets for 65 yards. That's a 7.2 yards per target, and that's a 55.6% success rate. Mm-hmm. I multiply them, I get 4.0 YTS. He had 1 explosive play, which is a 20-yard reception in that span. He had 2, I'm stealing another baseball statistic, the concept of quality starts. Okay. In baseball, that's 6+ innings and 3 or fewer earned runs. Mm-hmm. I'm going 7 and 3 rather than 6 and 3. That's 7+ yards per target and 3+ receptions. And the idea is, you know, that's not going to get you in the Pro Bowl, but that's a steady kind of chain move in, like, you know, just an average kind of professional, like helping the passing offense move along. And he had two of those in his first four games. In the last six games, so remember, four YTS and two QS and one explosive. The past six games, he's had 24 catches on 27 targets for 292 yards and five touchdowns.
So
that's 10.8 yards per target. That's an 89% success rate. Remember, his YTS in the first four games was four. In the last six games, it's 9.6. He's had five quality starts in those games and three explosive plays. He's been... His max yardage in those games has only been 66. So he has not had like a dominant all-pro Mark Andrews kind of day. So I believe it's flown under fans' radars that he has quietly crept to the top of, you know, reliability and productivity. He's been just a tremendous player the last six games.
Yeah, 9.9 yards per target by the official stats. And Andrews is the all-time record holder for the Ravens in a single year with 11.04. But the Ravens, you know, across the board with Lamar's great season are having fantastic yards per target years. It's interesting how you define that. I'll talk to you offline sometime about different positions. I would do it differently, probably.
Yeah.
I don't have anybody else I really need to talk about. I think I'd look at this game from Justice Hill and say this: he definitely did not have a good statistical game in terms of either receiving or in terms of running. It wasn't a high success rate game. He's very important to the Ravens.
Yes.
And you know what he's been doing as terms of used as a set and chip blocker, and he's used three times as a set blocker and five times as a chip blocker, which was the most of each by the Ravens. It's important, and sometimes it's important even if he doesn't make every block that needs to. And you can look at a PFF blocker rating for him, and he doesn't necessarily show up that well. That's not really telling the full story. What I think has been particularly good this year is when they haven't had a high set and chip load on him, that he's had a little more time to float to a better space where he can make a reception, keep his eyes on the field, understand who's ahead of him, and make some of these just wonderful third down, you know, 0+15 receptions he's made for the Ravens this year.
He's become such a complete player. He's really just a tremendous development story. And obviously the player, you know, development isn't something that is done to a player by the coaching staff. The player develops, you know, so that speaks to his effort and his mental abilities. And it's just a hell of a story.
Yeah. In terms of yards per target, I mean, he was way down there prior in his career. He was, his yards per target was under five for his career coming into this year. And it's 9.1 this year.
Now, yeah, so that's ridiculous. And I think maybe also we might not understand what the comps are, because running back yards per target are lower.
Much
than
lower.
Than wide receiver and tight end targets, except, you know, for Justice Hill.
Yeah, but some of this, and this has always been kind of a problem for Hill, I think. I feel like he hasn't had the good kind of receptions as a percentage of targets that he's had in past years. And this year he's 27 out of 30, which is that's a 90% catch rate. But his catch rate for his career is, before this year, let me do it this way, was 53 for 71. So he's catching not even, it's over two thirds of the balls, but it's not three quarters of the balls.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for a running back, that's not particularly good.
So I also don't have much to say about another skill position player. I would have called out Bateman and his six successes, but you did that already, or we talked about it in the first segment, maybe. So I wouldn't need to talk about another skill position player.
Let's move on to some mailbag questions here and see what they have here. So I did have from Reddit yesterday. I'm going to try and get as many from the Twitter today, and that includes some people who might ask a defensive question. One of the questions is from Mark_DH89, who says, do you think the Ravens should consider having Marlon travel with wide receiver ones? The Ravens have been the worst team in the NFL against opponents' best receivers, and after what Chase did, I think it's worth considering. Okay, it's a defensive question, but that's okay, because we got a new set of eyes on this problem. You heard a lot about what Michael Crawford's ideas were about this, but Jim, what do you think about that?
So I think that, hell yes, but more broadly, I think that, Marlon's success rate against Jamar Chase isn't anything to brag about either. But I think that anything that makes your defense less static and predictable is to be lauded. And Brandon Stevens, you know, he's doing his best and in some ways playing very well, but he needs a little bit of change of pace. I think that they should mix it up a little bit. I don't think it should be as static as it has been.
Okay. Now that's, I think you put it very well here. I maybe state it slightly differently. And I also think I'd make a different call on Humphrey, but the start is that the Ravens play a set side cornerback deal. So Wiggins, we on the field, is always at left corner.
Defensive left. So we're looking at the offense and it's our left. It's the offense's right side.
That's correct. The offensive right side. He's on the receiver that is typically on the strong side of the field. And that means that the right corner is Stevens, typically, who is usually getting the X receiver. And a lot of teams, that's their guy.
Yeah.
You know? And that X receiver gets a big percentage of the space budget that the offense has. And you want your guy over there to be pretty sticky. The change I would make is I'd move Wiggins over to right corner right now. I'd probably move Stevens, even though it's not going to make him happy to hear this. I'd move him to safety because that's where the Ravens' need is. And I think it would improve his ability to look into the backfield, find the football, playing on the back end, have a better chance to make choices about where he's going. It's not like he hasn't played the position. It's not like he's not the right size. They used him, in fact, as recently as – was it this year or last year? It was last year, I think, when they had Williams hurt, he moved to safety for a period of time, even though he played almost every snap the whole year and people think he played right corner the whole year. Was in one of the first couple of games, I think, when Williams was hurt, that he moved to safety for a set of snaps in there. And last year at the beginning of the year, before he won the job, they were looking at him at safety and then at slot corner, and then they finally moved him into it to be the right corner full time after, you know, they were out of other options. And, you know, he obviously he played quite well last year. And this year he's not playing as well. I still think he'd be a lot better if he had better help over the top, because only would it would make it easier for him to react to what's going on, not be as worried about getting beat by double moves. But I think the guy you want over there is probably Wiggins, a sticky guy, not afraid to get beat. Really believes in his makeup speed, and then also you have him on with a number one and you have help as well. And it almost forces that. And then I'd leave Humphrey on an island with the number two. I'd leave Humphrey on an island on the other side. And I wouldn't mind having Humphrey in the slot, because that physicality he gives you is extremely valuable. But you have multiple options. I think Wiggins and Humphrey on the outside right now might be the best pairing that they've got. And then with probably Stevens moving to safety would be what I would recommend if you're going to make one kind of change to the secondary right now on this 10-day hiatus, that would be it. And if you don't
do it
now,
Marcus Williams come off the field in that instant scenario?
Does he stop playing full time? Maybe. Does he go to playing the Eddie Jackson role? Maybe. I mean, I think you have multiple choices there. They don't really have another guy who's an obvious free safety is the problem. So I almost think he becomes Brandon Stevens becomes the strong safety, and Williams stays at free, and you're then free to have Hamilton up near the line of scrimmage somewhere where you want him. And then there's going to be plays, I think, under that scenario where Stevens or Williams comes off the field for Hamilton to move back on some plays.
Oh yeah.
All right. Let's go to another question here. That's a good one. But I really appreciate that, Mark, and we're happy to get to it on the defensive show. Here we've got another one from Brandon Croxton. This is an offensive question. Considering that the Lamar Henry read option is almost at the brotherly shove level of unstoppable plays, should the Ravens consider going for 2 points every time after a TD? If you succeed 75% of the time, you still add 2 extra points for every 4 TDs scored. Great thinking, Brandon. And, you know, I don't think it would take a 75% rate for them to do that. If you don't happen to recognize that name right away, or you think, oh, where have I heard that name before? He's been a guest on this show a number of times, and he's done a defensive show once already this year. I'm sure we'll have him on again. But if their success rate was 75%, no doubt about it, they try it every time. Where are you on that, Jim? What's your minimum success rate to have the 2-point conversion be the one you try under normal circumstances?
So you are asking me that question from the arithmetic mathematical standpoint, and my assessment of the question is not on that plane. My assessment is that you are leading a football team of players who you have to keep bought into your decision making. And I think as much as possible, you don't risk it when you have a high power offense that is putting touchdowns on the board. Just take the seven. You know, what did they score? Touchdowns on four consecutive drives this time against Tampa. They scored, I believe they scored. They weren't all touchdowns on six consecutive drives. Yep. They just keep it going. Put up seven, put up seven, put up seven. Don't give the offense any, don't give the offensive players any opportunity to question your play calling or any opportunity to feel that this touchdown drive was not 1,000% a success. Come off the field with your extra point and your 7 points and then put seven on them again next time and keep doing it. I think that if you have a less successful offense or you are there, obviously there are high leverage situations where, you know, 2 points is absolutely the correct call. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying discard the 2 point play, but I do not think that with this successful offense, I do not think that it should be the normal go to unless we're talking some absurdly high percentage, you know, success rate on it.
75 is pretty absurdly high. So
I was going to say 8, and that's close enough to 75. Okay. So we're in that ballpark. I just don't think, I think that we're in the realm of mental effects rather than actual valid statistical thinking until it gets, you know, in that 80% range.
Okay. I'll say this, and this is maybe a different way to do it mathematically. If you could get your, it doesn't even have to be much over 50%. If we were to 55%, then I would be in favor of every single time you're down 14, regardless of point in the game, when you score to cut it to 8, you always go for 2. Always. It's automatically the best move from about halftime on in NFL games. You only have to have about a 38% success rate. But I think if you had that, if you had that kind of expected success rate, the only downside I could see to doing it as often as Brandon is suggesting, like you might do it, you know, 4 times a game, 5 times a game, is that you're going to have a pretty big stable of 2 point plays to maintain that. And you're going to put your offense at a little bit more injury risk. I'm not terribly concerned about that.
Including QB1.
Yeah. Including QB1, but it's because he's going to have to run and you're going to want to use the mesh point and yes. Brandon is making that point. But I really love the idea. And Brandon, this is something that ought to be suggested, I think, more prominently to people like John, to Harbaugh, to figure out if he would buy into this notion. And I think part of the question that you would have about it, I think you pose it to the players in part and say, hey, look, guys, we're going to go into this and we're going to practice 2 point conversions very heavily this week because we're going to score a bunch of touchdowns. This defense, I don't think can stop them, but look at this as a experiment here or an investment in what this offense has done. I mean, we believe in you guys. We know you're going to score over half the time. We're not just going to stop doing it because you miss occasionally. And we're going to do it in the highest leverage situations. And it's going to work out most of the time.
I think that you just said that you would start it in a game that you expect to win fairly easily against an outmatched opponent.
You could try that. Yeah.
I thought that was what you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah. You certainly could. And you know, you're point by point as you go through a game, you could still make a different decision about
sure.
it. If a single point puts you up 9, then you might not go for 2 and risk staying up 7. You know, it's a different, if it's a, you know, you have different conditions that you want to put on the situation. So, you know, I would just say under normal neutral kind of point situations where you're at an even score, 7 or 3 distance, Brandon, I think it's an excellent idea. Yeah. All right. Let's go to another question here. See if we've got another one for the offense. Let's see. Matabike, Orr's system, Hamilton injury, Travis Jones, Chuck Pagano. Okay, well, this
was interesting. So it is no surprise, I think, that after this performance that we would have a lot of questions about the defense.
About the defense, yeah. But some positive questions about Travis Jones and whatnot. Felix Billington, I have not seen this name. It's _Felix_B_, if you're one of the big underscore people on Twitter. Hey, Ken, love the pod. Thank you. Do you think there's an opportunity to leverage Bateman's contract into another favorable deal? Do you think he would be open to taking a 3-year, $40 million deal at the end of this, of the end of the year? So he is still so far from free agency. So, okay. So the point is he's 2 years from free agency. He has one of the best contracts in football. And I hope what Felix means is a tack on 3 for $40 on the end of that, where he'll get a big signing bonus to go with that. Effectively, he's got to play 5 years with the Ravens. I think he might have to wait until the end of 25 to get his extension.
I would think so too. Yeah.
But I do it. What do you
say? Costa has plenty of work to do this offseason. And I think that he's done his Bateman work, you know, last year, and that he's got that one crossed off for thinking about for the next year. Yeah. Bateman is he right? So he's clearly grown this year and has shown that he can be a positive football player on your team. Has he shown enough to deserve a bigger contract?
So he's 3 for $40 isn't wide receiver one money.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't that's be too true. Concerned about that. That's you know, it would be in the top 25% of wide receiver contracts league wide, but there's a lot of wide receivers in the league. So
yeah,
you know, there's your average number per team is probably 1.25 who are making that much money. Given the success of the offense, I wouldn't have a problem with it. It would be on the table as one of the choices in terms of cheap extension opportunities available at the end of 25. Mm-hmm. The other players that'll be really important at the end of 25 are Hamilton, and any second year player. There won't be Flowers because Flowers has a 5th year option. So what other second year player is going to be up after 25? Tavius Robinson would be one who might be a player you'd consider signing early after 3 years after 25. And Keaton Mitchell might be another one. Trenton Simpson might be another one. Simpson is a lower round pick, so he'd be a guy you have to get early. So the Ravens have several every year. That's exactly what you want. Is you want to have several choices where you can really make the franchise altering decisions on. And if you might lose them a year forward, then you take your chances. And the great thing about teams that draft well is they have to make lots of heartbreaking decisions, and it sucks for fans. It really does, but it's.
I like the way you phrase that because it's so much better than the alternative. The reason it sucks for fans is because we're drafting well and bringing in good players. That is preferable to the alternative.
Yep, absolutely. All right, we're going to have to call it there for the night. Great questions, by the way. Always adds a lot to the show to have some good new avenues of thought. And really appreciate that. But more than that, Jim, appreciate you having you on for these 2 hours. And so it's always fun to talk football with you. Tell folks where they can catch up with you online.
Find me on Twitter. I will be reading and replying to, Cole and Ken and MC and all the guys who are on Ravens Twitter. Also on Threads, if you are on Threads as an alternative to Twitter. And after every game in the regular season, I write a column that appears on RSR about the Ravens receiving game. That usually appears either Wednesday or Thursday.
All right. Really appreciate always at the end of a long show like this, a long double show. I always know that it's the most loyal listeners of all that are still with us. Thank you for staying on. If you want to do something nice for the show, I've got 3 recommendations. One is show somebody new the show, try to get them to play it directly off the website. Maybe if it's an older person, particularly who's not particularly facile with podcasts. So if you're running into me, that would be the way to get me to listen to whatever true crime podcast you like or whatever. I've become a little more facile with YouTube videos lately, but that's this is something I think there are a lot of older people who just aren't into podcasts in the same way. Mm-hmm. And always, write us a 5-star 50-word review if you don't mind taking 10 minutes out of your day to say some things. That helps drive traffic to the show, and always really appreciate it. The other thing you do, # Film Study Mailbag with your questions. They always provide us with some great new content. Thanks a lot for listening. Jim, thanks again for coming on.
And thank you so much for having me as a guest. It's a pleasure.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you, most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.